This morning, we're going to have a talk on a pain management thing that a lot of us deal with in our practice all the time, epidurals. Dr. Jonathan Kamerlink is an anesthesiologist who's board certified in anesthesia and pain. He went to medical school at Rush University in Chicago and then did a fellowship in spine research at NYU and HSS. Subsequent to that, he did an anesthesia residency in Illinois and then a pain management fellowship back in Boston at Beth Israel. And he's in private practice doing a lot of the pain management stuff that a lot of us get stuck sending our patients to. So he'll be back in a second. He'll give us a talk on the indications for epidural steroid injections.
Good morning, everybody. Sorry, I'm a couple minutes late here. But I wanted to talk about epidural steroid injections. It's probably the most common procedure any interventional pain specialist does on a regular basis. I get phone calls all the time from different doctors. Hey, can you do a shot for my patient? And I'm thinking, well, we need to have a little bit of mutual understanding about exactly what type of injections, what to expect from them, how we do them. I think that it's just good general knowledge specifically for the residents so they have a firm understanding what an interventional pain specialist can do. So we're going to go over what's the true indications for doing an epidural steroid injection. We're going to talk about the imaging that needs to be done. What's the exact mechanism for how an epidural really helps people, the types and techniques, and then I'm going to show about three examples and talk about the outcomes for these patients here. So really, what is an indication for an epidural? Again, I get phone calls all the time. Hey, my patient's got back pain. Can you do a shot for them to make them feel a lot better? And it's just not really that clear exactly what people are trying to get at. And, you know, back pain is different than having the sciatic radicular type of pain. So realistically, the literature has said that doing an epidural for radicular pain, that's pain in the neck, radiating all the way down the shoulder. Some patients will even just complain of neck pain radiating to the shoulder or to the scapula that is in a radicular pattern, even though if you look at any of the dermatomal distribution maps, they'll say that C6, C7, you should be having the shooting pain down the arm. If you go back and you look at a lot of those studies of the dermatomal maps, it was basically, I think they used maybe 20 different cadavers that they looked at. And think about it. We have 325 million Americans. You think that there's going to be some aberration in that anatomy? Of course there is. Some people don't have that shooting pain down their arm. Maybe just going down to the shoulder a little bit, going to the scapula a little bit, maybe just going to the mid-thoracic spine area. Not unusual for that. The same thing with in the lumbar spine as well, too. They may have some pain that's coming from the low back, going to the buttock area. Maybe it's shooting down all the way to the foot. They may just be complaining of some tingling sensation in their feet. For whatever reason, I've had a slew of patients lately that have neuropathy, never had cancer, with no chemo, no radiation. They're not HIV patients, and they're not diabetic patients. But for some reason, a lot of people past the age of 65, they're developing this neuropathy in their extremities. And I wouldn't be surprised if some of it is coming from their lumbar spine. Most common reasons that we're doing these epidurals are in the younger population is because of a herniated disc. In the older populations, because they have spinal stenosis. Either they have central canal stenosis, where the whole spinal cord sits, or the foramen, where the nerve roots are coming out and going down to the arm or the leg. So here's just a bird's eye view of some of the anatomy here. This is what we think of a normal lumbar spine here. You have your spinal canal where the termination of the spinal cord sits there. The nerve roots come out of the neuroforamen. And here's something that's not normal here. So let's go one by one here about the different pathology here. So a pinched nerve. So you can have a couple of reasons why you have a pinched nerve. You could have an enlarged facet joint, which we'll get to a little bit later. You could have a herniated disc. Even though I said it's usually in a younger person, you can get that in an older person. I'll show an example of someone that's 65. She has a herniated disc, clear-cut radicular pain. We'll look at her MRI images there, and it was really bothering her. You can also have enlargement of the ligamentum flavum back there, where it causes very, very tight central canal stenosis, or you can just have a natural narrowing of the spinal canal as well, too. Facet arthropathy, that's basically arthritis of the facet joint there. They can either be complaining of pure back pain, which is facet in nature, or the facet can be enlarged, and it can be pushing on the nerve root. So they could have really bad back pain. They say, oh, doc, every time I lean back or I twist, or specifically here in Boca, when I play golf, it really bothers me a lot, that twisting motion. And then when I twist, I get that shooting pain down my leg. So what's happening is the facet is basically rocking against each other, and then they're moving it in a certain way, and they're pushing on that nerve root, and they're getting that shooting pain down their leg. So a lot of primaries will just send me patients without any diagnostic imaging, which I actually prefer, because this way I can order the imaging that I want. I see patients that have they'll have x-rays, and then they'll have a CAT scan, and then they come and see me, and then I got to order an MRI. And the patients are they're frustrated. They paid a lot of money for a lot of this diagnostic imaging, and it's really not the imaging of choice. So usually when patients come to see me, I'm at the point where I'm not going to bother with x-rays because I'm pretty sure they don't have a fracture. But even if they have a fracture, you may not see it on an x-ray. If you have a compression fracture, you're never going to really see it on an x-ray unless it's old and it's already wedged already. It's really that we need to look on the STIR sequence of the MRI that you're going to see that it's acute in nature. If they've had prior back surgery, usually I order it with contrast just to make sure there's no signs of infection. Pretty low probability. If you are ordering MRIs, in order to do it at contrast, some facilities will have it, some won't. Here in the hospital, obviously, we do. But some of the freestanding places, I think the Medicare rules, you have to have a physician on premises in order to administer contrast. So some of them will do that, some of them won't do that. So here's some of the data that's come out about doing these MRIs. Some of the insurance companies, you have to kind of jump through a lot of hoops in order to get them authorized. Probably the hardest one is Blue Cross Blue Shield. They usually require 6 weeks of conservative treatment, and I'll show you the study that they base that off. 6 weeks of conservative treatment, which includes anti-inflammatories, maybe Tylenol, and they need to have a physical therapy evaluation. They don't even have to have treatment, just an evaluation, which kind of blows my mind, but as we all know, it's really just about as many hurdles that we can put up so that we don't have to pay for a lot of these images. So this was a study that came out from Steve Cohn and Johns Hopkins. He's a pretty well-respected pain guy. And they looked at whether getting an MRI really changed what we did for these epidurals. And he said that it didn't really affect the clinical outcomes at all, and it had a very small bearing. I'll tell you, in my practice, I look at every MRI of my patients. I like to know exactly where the pathology is because I think the key is to really have targeted therapy. The closer you are to the issue, the closer you are to putting in the steroid, local anesthetic, whatever you're injecting, I think that you have a better outcome from it. Here's some of the studies that the insurers use and they cite on a regular basis for kind of their decision-making, whether they're going to pay for these imaging studies. The first one here came out of the American College of Physicians saying that the only need for getting an MRI is when there's serious or progressive neurological deficits, or if you're doing it in preparation of an epidural or surgery. This bottom one, this is where Blue Cross gets their main notion here. This came from the American College of Occupational Environmental Medicine, that they have to have their symptoms for 6 weeks in order to really undergo an MRI. Again, I don't really agree with these guidelines because the insurers, they're not really weighing the whole thing. They're just looking at their financial perspective. If you take the whole patient in totality, let's say you have a 50-year-old patient that is out of work because they have severe sciatic pain. It's a huge cost to society, to their employer, to their family, to their mental health, that they're not getting better. So 6 weeks, that's a long time to be waiting about these things. So I think this is a bunch of bogus stuff here that the insurers are using to kind of inflate things. In my practice, I don't bother with x-rays. I don't bother with CT scans. I go straight to MRIs. And even with MRIs now, with the pacemaker compatible and the AICD compatible devices, there's no reason that they have to have MRIs. I've actually talked to radiology department now, even the older devices that they'll scan people with the older devices in. So it doesn't really matter, but it has to be done here in the hospital. They have to have a rep from that company that will interrogate the device before having the MRI, and then they'll interrogate it afterwards. The likelihood that the MRI is really going to change anything to those devices, pretty low probability. These devices are very, very sophisticated now, and they've done plenty of anatomical studies that the MRI machine is not really triggering anything in the devices, so there's no reason for it. So how does an epidural really work? You know, you send them to me, I do a shot for them, and miraculously your patients are better. So it's a few different mechanisms here. So it inhibits the production of phospholipase A2. It reduces the arachidonic acid. It suppresses the impulses from those damaged nerve fibers. I'm not saying damaged like they've been cut, but they've been impinged either because of that disc herniation, they have severe spinal stenosis, and it's constant pushing on there. And the last thing, it depresses the impulses from the unmyelinated C fibers. Those are the fibers that send that that dull kind of aching sensation. Now, even after I do an epidural and patients are feeling much better, they still will complain about some achingness, maybe some shooting pain a little bit. With the neurological system, I've noticed that even if you've taken away some of that impingement, it takes several weeks for that fully to resolve. The nervous system, it just doesn't make a change right away. It takes a long time to kind of get used to the new normal there. There are some studies that looked at just injecting local anesthetic into the epidural space to see if that makes any difference. And there are some studies that say that injecting steroid and local anesthetic versus just local anesthetic alone, there's really no difference in outcomes. I beg to differ. I think that there is a huge difference in injecting steroid into people, and I think that the outcomes are much better. But just the local anesthetic alone increases the blood flow because it creates a sympathetic block. So it dilates the blood vessels so that there's more blood flow, so more likelihood that they're going to take up any of those inflammatory cytokines that we just talked about. Or it's a washout effect where we're injecting anywhere from 3 to 5 milliliters into the epidural space, and it's basically a dilutional effect. So there's a few different techniques of how we do epidurals. Some of the things that we have to watch out for. first thing is we're always worried about blood thinners. I see more patients now than ever that are on different blood thinner medications. There are a bunch of new ones that just came to market. There's Brilinta. Eliquis is really relatively new. Plavix has been around for a while. But there's different amounts of time that we have to stop these medications. It's largely been based on the half-lives of these medications, but now there's going to be some studies coming out saying that there's really no difference, that the outcomes and the rates of having epidural hematomas with stopping and not stopping these medications really doesn't make a big difference. And there's a risk. I mean, there's a reason why all our patients are on these blood thinner medications. They've had a stroke. They've had a PE. They got stents in their heart. So it's a tough risk. It's a tough decision to really determine that is it safe for them to go off, because people have gone off of it, and I've heard from some of my colleagues, they've stopped people that have been on Plavix for prevention of strokes, and the patient had a stroke while they were waiting for having an epidural by stopping it. So let's talk about the technique about how we do it. In the neck area, we only do an injection where we go straight from the middle. You may have heard of what's called a selective nerve root block or transforaminal. It's really fallen out of favor in the cervical spine because it's really not safe. There's a higher chance they're going to hit the intervertebral artery and you're going to cause some serious damage for the patient. In the low back, we can do a caudal epidural, and I'm going to show you some diagrams exactly how we do it. You go straight in the middle for like we do in the cervical spine, or you can go from the side right into the foramen as well too. And we'll talk about the pluses and minuses of each one. So a caudal epidural is where we stick a needle into the caudal space. Sometimes we inject directly through the needle. Sometimes we'll feed a catheter all the way up to the level of the lumbar or the thoracic spine that there's an issue. I usually reserve this technique for someone who's had previous spine surgery because there's a higher likelihood that they're going to have some type of adhesions in their lumbar spine. It's the safest out of all the epidural steroid injections because the chances of hitting any type of nerve root in the caudal space is a very, very low probability. And the catheter that we feed up is polyurethane plastic material. So it's not going to pierce the dura. It's not going to go into any artery. So it's basically going to follow a potential space. Same type of technique when we're doing for labor epidurals. Put a needle in, feed the catheter in, wherever the catheter goes, it goes. So it's the safest out of all the techniques. The first one I'm going to talk here is what's called an interlaminar, where we're going basically straight in the middle. I go slightly off to one side or the other based on the patient's symptom. There's a small ligament that goes right in the epidural space in the middle. It's called the plica. And it basically separates the two spaces there. Even though in theory it's a continuous space, I can promise you when you go off to one side or the other, most of the medication will stay on that side. It's the second safest out of all the epidural steroid injections. You're going right in between the intraspinous ligament, then the interspinous ligament through the ligament flavum, and then basically end up in the epidural space. So it's, again, the epidural space is the space above the dura. So people think that the epidural space has its own location. It's really just a potential space between the dura and the ligamentum flavum, and it's continuous all the way around. Even though there's a dividing point in the back part there, if you continue all the way around to the front part, it's continuous. The last type of technique for doing an epidural is a transforaminal injection, where you can basically see that you're going from the side there right into the foramen, and the hope that the medication will flow all the way up through the nerve root into the epidural space. The problem with that technique is a couple of things. The first thing is there's a potential that you can hit a artery that sits in there, and that's the radicular artery that basically feeds the spinal cord. You can infarct the cord, and the patient becomes paralyzed because of that. Usually that's with particulate steroid. Most pain specialists now, when they do a transforaminal, they're using a non-particulate steroid like dexamethasone. Again, I personally don't think that it's as beneficial to patients as using a particulate steroid like depomedrol or Kenalog. So that's great. We know about all these epidurals. What's really the outcomes from these patients? Because really, is what I see in healthcare over the next 5 years, that we're going to go to an outcome-based type of reimbursement, outcome-based, evidence-based medicine thing. Even though we've talked about it, I think we're really at that precipice right now. So what's the point of doing these epidurals? So you send them off to a pain specialist. They inject. The patients come back and they see you. They say, oh, doc, I'm no better. But there's actually real data about this. This was, the same gentleman, Steve Cohn. He does a lot of research with him and Jim Rathmel, who's at, Steve's at Johns Hopkins. Jim Rathmel, he's now at Brigham. They're really into the evidence-based medicine. So they looked at a bunch of epidurals, a fairly large series. I don't remember the exact numbers, but 70% of patients with radicular symptoms were better by 6 months. Significantly. The technique and how they do that, that's kind of still up in there, and we'll talk about the different techniques, what the outcomes are. But that's pretty significant. Again, go back to your 40, 50-year-old patient. I've even had 30-year-old patients that have had disc herniations. They feel miserable. They have shooting pain down their leg. They can't stand up. They can't go to work. They're miserable at home. They're terrible to their spouse, their kids, because they're so crabby, because they're so uncomfortable. You can't put them on certain medications. Opioids, I think, are terrible for the management of this type of stuff in the long term, maybe for the first couple of days. Maybe you're going to put them on anti-inflammatories. They're going to complain that their stomach is hurting them because you're putting them on anti-inflammatories. You may have put them on a Medrol dose pack and say, hey, I feel great on the Medrol dose pack, but as soon as I stopped it, my pain came back again. Again, systemic steroids, when we can really do a targeted therapy for them. But they're out of work. It's that cost to society of what's happening to these patients because they're not able to function at a normal level here. This was probably one of the largest series of epidural steroid injections that has been studied in the literature to date. They looked at 4,200 different injections on 1,800 patients over 7 years. And they found that there was actually no major complications identified. No one become paralyzed. There was no more significant morbidity or mortality from this. There was a very low rate of complications from these 2.4%, mostly patients complaining of pain in the injection site, persistent numbness. Again, very subjective experience, but the overall thing is that these injections are actually very, very safe. Other studies have quoted that the chance of major complications are maybe 1 in 100,000. I think using a fluoroscopic guidance, which is pretty much the standard of care, Medicare and all the commercial payers have bundled using fluoroscopic guidance with doing epidural steroid injections now. And I think that the chances of complications are probably in the range of 1 to 250,000, maybe 1 in 500,000. Most pain specialists are going to have relatively no complications from these procedures. Again, done correctly, right safety precautions, and have done a fair amount of injections over the years. With the transforaminal, that's where we're going by the side there, that we're injecting right by the foramen, and there's talk that some pain specialists are doing these types of injections on patients that are on blood thinners because you're not in the epidural space. If there's a hematoma formation, it's outside the spinal column, so it's really not that big of a deal for them. But there have been some incidences where radicular arteries have been hit, and it's basically infarcted the cord. Again, very, very rare complication, but devastating to the patient. Might as well just take your checkbook out, and it's horrible. And both of these cases, they're from Chicago. I know both of the authors here, and they're very devastating to see happen here. Now the question is, let's compare all these different injections that are out there. Is there really any significant benefit? And they've actually found nothing. There's no difference between all these types of techniques of epidurals. The key is really just getting the needle as close to the problem as you can, doing the injection safely, getting the patient feeling better, getting them mobilized again, getting them involved in physical therapy, and ultimately trying to prevent the need for surgery. Because the outcomes from surgery are about 50%, which is really not amazing. So I tell patients all the time, either my injection is either going to help you or really do nothing at all. The chances of making it significantly worse, pretty low probability. In the grand scheme of their entire care, I think it's a pretty calculated risk, and I think it's relatively worth it. Another study looking at doing the injection from the side, going straight in the middle, no difference in their overall functionality. Let's talk about cost. Again, things going forward in the future is going to be outcomes, and I think comparing costs. And I think you've kind of been hearing this in the literature now for the last maybe 10, 15 years. What is it really impacting the patients, and is it financially worth it? Going forward, Medicare and all the commercial payers, what the outcomes are, no one's really going to know. I think we all participate in MIPS. I think that the stuff that MIPS collects and says that we're good, we're bad at what we do, I don't think it's really great data. I don't think it's amazing. Even though I'm a specialist, I still have to collect the same data as the primary care physicians are out there. Pretty much every specialist has to do it. Again, I think that there should be criteria for primary care physicians and then criteria for every different specialty to really see what outcomes are, because that's what we really care about. I don't want to be injecting people that maybe they're feeling better for a week or two. I want to be injecting people that they're feeling better for months at a time. They have significant increase in their activity. Yes, a lot of our patients around here are retirees, and they're not working on a regular basis, but they still need to be functioning. They're laying in bed. They're not moving around. Higher chance that they're going to develop a DVT. Higher chance they're going to get overweight. Higher chance that their blood sugars are going to get out of control. Their blood pressure is going to get out of control. And psychologically, they're going to become very depressed about that. So this, again, it's another cost to society. If we can prevent any of these things from happening, from a cost perspective, it's much better. It's much better and easier to treat diseases in their early state than in their latter states. This is a study that came out of a collaboration with University of Michigan and then a private group back in 2013, where they looked at changing the algorithm of how we approach these patients. So I kind of compare this to cardiologists and cardiothoracic surgeons. So back in the 80s, patient came to go see their primary care doctor, their cardiologist. They had blockage. You went straight to the cardiothoracic surgeon. You had a bypass surgery, and that was it. And then bunch of radiologists said, hey, well, let's take a balloon up there and let's see if we can angioplasty it open. And then the cardiologist said, hey, we're going to take that over. We're gonna do that angioplasty. And not only are we going to do an angioplasty, we're going to put a stent up there. Same thing with spine surgery. Anytime someone went to go see their internist or their primary care physician, said, doc, I got terrible back pain. Immediately, you went to go see an orthopedic surgeon or a neurosurgeon, got evaluated, and they were going to do surgery on you. Well, we've seen, again, that the outcomes from spine surgery are not amazing. For degenerative patterns, that is. If someone has caught a quinine, they have neurological deficits, totally different situation, absolutely they should go for emergent surgery. But our utilization of spine surgery in America is significantly higher than other countries in the world, to the point where, you know, you got to really stop and think about it. And the patients they're very savvy about this stuff now. The word has kind of spread. They go online. They talk to their friends. They say, oh, my friend had two or three back surgeries. They're worse off. They're not doing well. I don't ever want to have back surgery. And I tell the patients, look, I agree. I mean, it's not amazing to have back surgery. The outcomes aren't wonderful from it. It's a pretty morbid procedure. And before you know, one spine surgery leads to another. But don't get me wrong, I still refer to my surgical colleagues, but in the right indication and at the right time. Again, I tell patients all the time, if they don't have any severe neurological deficits, there's no need to run off and have spine surgery. Before I left my fellowship program at Beth Israel Deaconess, Massachusetts General was kind of experimenting with a similar type of idea of like that University of Michigan did, that they were developing an algorithm for patients that got admitted to through the emergency room for low back and sciatic type of pain. And they were randomizing the patient to see a physiatrist that was also boarded in pain management and then also anesthesia pain, and then randomizing whether they were going to see neurosurgery or orthospine for consultation if needed. During that admission, the patient would be admitted, 23-hour obs, they do an MRI, found they have some stenosis, do an injection for them, and then if needed, they would be consulting the surgical services. And they found that the utilization of spine surgery dramatically decreased, and their outcomes were actually much better. At MGH and Brigham, that's Partners Healthcare, they self-insure, so they could internally see all that data financially, how much it was costing them. And they found that the utilization of healthcare dramatically decreased by having more of an algorithm-based approach to these patients. University of Michigan, they did the same thing, where they looked at comparing the utilization of spine surgery injections, and they found that the amount of surgery actually decreased, and they were able to increase the reimbursement to spine surgery. So again, if we're able to justify to Medicare, all the commercial payers, that hey, they have better outcomes doing it this way, here's the data to support it. But when we do surgery or we do injections, we want to get paid more for it because the stuff actually makes a significant impact on patients. Again, if I do an injection for them and they're feeling much better, chances are they're going to have less doctor visits because they're feeling much better, less chance that they're going to be on medications, less chance that they're going to be prescribed opioid medicines. I mean, the opioid business, that's dramatically changed here in South Florida in the last, almost 9 months now. I see the amount of patients that are on opioids, it's decreasing exponentially. A lot of these people are happy about it. Again, the chronic pain patients that are on opioid medications, they're not too thrilled because they can't get their opioids like they used to, but I think overall, I think we're taking a step in the right direction here. Alternatives to what I do, surgery and medication. We just talked about this stuff. Not amazing alternatives. Anti-inflammatories. You talk to any of these old people, they're going to tell you, oh, I take a leaf. I pop it like candy all day long. Before you know it, they end up with a gastric ulcer. They're in the ER. They perforated. Their blood pressure is through the roof. Their kidneys are shot. You know, these patients, they think that over-the-counter medications, they don't have side effects. Of course they do. Just because you can go get a leave at Walgreens, CVS, doesn't mean that there's not without risk. But the funny part is anytime I prescribe them a medication like gabapentin, Lyrica, doc, I don't want that. There's too many side effects from that. I said, that's funny. Why don't you go read the side effects of Tylenol or any type of anti-inflammatory and then tell me that you're not scared about taking any of that stuff. I think it's a huge societal problem that the mentality of the average American to think that an over-the-counter medication is completely safe it boggles my mind. And I think that I spend time educating my patients that extra minute or two per my visit. I find that it saves me time downstream. Less chance that I'm going to have phone calls in my office, less chance that the patients are going to do something stupid and go take, you know, 5 grams of acetaminophen. They're going to take a leave 10 times a day, all those types of things. So I think we need to educate patients about it. My recommendation for all this type of stuff is early intervention. Again, even though the insurance companies are showing you all this data saying, oh, it doesn't really make a difference, they're looking at it from their financial perspective. Our job is really to look at the societal cost. I think it's important to be aggressive about this stuff sooner, evaluate the patients, send them to a specialist like myself. Even most of the surgical colleagues, my surgical colleagues now, they want to have good outcomes too. So they may evaluate the patient. They may just tell the patient, look, go have an injection. I think it's going to help you significantly. And once you've tried all non-surgical options and you're still in significant pain, come and see me then, and then we'll talk about surgery. I image the patients. I think x-rays, aside from a major fracture or dislocation that you may see in a trauma bay, in the cervical, thoracic, or lumbar spine, for us in the community, I think that it's relatively a waste of time. Even CAT scans, it's a lot of radiation. There's no need for it. I think that going to the MRI is really the most important diagnostic tool. I do use anti-inflammatories, Lyrica, gabapentin, muscle relaxers. They'll complain of some spasm in their back. I try and keep people away from opioids. I don't think that, again, not that I'm scared of it. I just think that the data support it is pretty abysmal. I think that American psychology has to change. We've seen too many issues with opioid medications over the last 30-some years, and I think that the availability of opioids is going to diminish even more so than it is now. Let's talk about a few examples here. These are three patients that I've seen in my actual practice here. This was a 62-year-old male I saw probably about 4 months ago complaining of severe low back and leg pain, very debilitating. He had a prior issue with this maybe 10 years before seeing me, had an injection, felt really good, came out of nowhere, was in agony, wasn't able to work. This is a gentleman, he does... he's an accountant, travels all over the state of Florida, was pretty miserable, hunched over when he came to see me in the office here. Here's his MRI pictures of sagittal and axial. Even though he was complaining of left leg pain, if you look at the axials here, you can see his impingement's actually on the right side. And I see this a lot. Even though we look at all these diagnostic tools, the key is to really correlate it with the patient. And that's why I spend a fair amount of time with my patients to see actually where their symptoms are. Because, again, you can look at these MRI. You take 100 people off the street in Boca Raton, you're going to find some type of pathology in their MRI. It's not unusual. The key is to really correlate it with their symptomatology, because that's where I want to inject. I want to get as close to the problem as possible. I'm not always right about it, but you got to really correlate it. So anyways, this gentleman, I saw him on a Thursday, terrible, he was miserable. I did an injection for him. Here's the injection. You can see the needles going slightly off to the left. It's called a parasagittal injection, basically where I go needle straight from the back there. It's the contrast in there. This is a contralateral oblique image. You can see the contrast right over here, and he did great. Walked out of my office, felt so much better. I saw him for follow-up a few weeks later. He's like, Doc, 100% of my pain is gone. I feel much better. Again, he's able to return to work. He's able to function like he normally. His wife said he was a crabby guy for at least a week before coming in to see me and was able to function normally in society. This is a 62-year-old female, very nice lady, an executive for one of the television companies out of New York, complaining of low back and right thigh pain. You can see here, here's her MRI. She had impingement here at L2, L3, right on the left side. So her symptoms correlated. You can see there's basically no space in the frame in here and that the nerve roots are being impinged, complaining of low back and really just right thigh pain. So this would be in the L2 nerve root that she was complaining of pain. did an injection for her, and she felt amazing the following day. No pain, able to return to a normal functional status, on relatively no medications. I think she occasionally takes a Tylenol for her exacerbation of her pain. But overall, she's doing much better, and I've only done one injection for her probably in a year. This last one, this is a 40-year-old female. Was sent to me by one of the radiologists, lady complaining of low back and left hip pain. She had a uterine artery ablation done by one of the interventional radiologists, was feeling great. And then all of a sudden, like a week after the ablation, she's like, oh, my God, I have terrible back pain, leg pain. So they thought maybe she was bleeding out something. The fibroid was pushing on something. They did an MRI on her. And she had a very slight disc herniation at L5-S1 right here. Again, if you compare the size on the right side, you can see there's pretty significant impingement over here. It doesn't look like a lot, but you have to remember that space is about maybe 5 millimeters, maybe 4 millimeters. So even a 1 millimeter, a half a millimeter shift is going to make a pretty significant impact on these patients. So this is the first two were very different type of pathology that was just pure degenerative spinal stenosis. This one is an actual disc herniation. I did an injection her again, the left side, stuck the needle. Here's the contrast. And I saw her for follow-up. She said, my pain is 100% gone. Again, the younger population is most likely going to have a disc herniation. I'm going to do one injection. They're going to feel better. And most likely, I'm probably never going to see them again. That's it. Any questions? I don't know about the literature. I just find anecdotally in my practice that the patients, what they usually complain about is spasm in the back, and I think that's because the nerve root is being impinged, and I think some of the sensory nerves go into the paraspinal muscles, and if they move their body and biomechanically they impinge that nerve root a little bit too much, they complain of really bad spasm, and that spasm is more bothersome than the numbness or the tingling sensation in their leg. So I may use it for a short amount of time until I do an injection. After doing the injection, I try and get people off all medications. So, yes, some of them do. Depends on which ones. I keep people on cyclobenzaprine, which is Flexeril, or tizanidine, which is Xanaflex. I keep people away from Soma, which has some addicting properties. Robaxin has some addicting properties. So those are the two that I see people are on chronically, and I'm willing to wager it's probably because of the addictive properties that they have. Again, I try and educate patients about that, and I try and get them off of those medications for that exact reason. Sure. Yes, I think that's fair. Blood sugars are usually going to go up for anywhere from 3 to 5 days after doing an injection. But I personally space out my injections at least 1 month in between. So it's not I inject on a Monday, then I see them Friday again and inject. I don't play that type of game. There are some people that will do the series of 3 injection, which has really fallen out of flavor. You do an injection, you see the patient a month later, see how they're doing. If they need another injection, maybe wait another week or two. So they should be relatively spaced out. They shouldn't be very close to each other. And I think that when they're very close, that's when you may be seeing that issues.
Thank you.
Sure. So for the residents, I actually prefer when patients come to see me and they've had no testing done. This way I can work them up appropriately. I think that a lot of the testing that's done out in the community, I think it's unnecessary. If you talk to any patient that has even had an EMG, they'll tell you how painful it is. All those tiny little needles going in you, the electricity going through there, they are miserable by that type of stuff. So if I can do some diagnostic imaging like an MRI, I much prefer it. So the most common way that someone is going to present to me symptomatically is that they're going to complain of neck pain with, again, that shooting pain into their shoulder. Maybe it's down their arm. They may have some tingling in their fingers, tingling in their toes, maybe a burning sensation, not unusual. again, in the low back, they'll say, oh, I have some pain in my low back, maybe some pain in my buttock area, maybe just some spasm in my low back. So let's break it down. What are the other possibilities from a musculoskeletal pathology? So in the neck area, it could be they have some impingement in the cervical spine. They may have some facet problems from the picture we showed before. They may have a rotator cuff issue, a shoulder issue. They may have some arthritis that's developed in the shoulder. So you really have to elucidate, is it a neck problem? Is it a shoulder problem? And then the low back, is it a back problem or it's a hip problem? Usually if it's a hip problem, they'll say, oh, it hurts right here on my side, and it goes all the way into my groin. But if they're saying, oh, it's my butt, and it's kind of going onto the outside of my thigh, pretty low probability that it's going to be a hip issue. It's probably either coming from the back, or maybe they have some bursitis in the outside part of their hip. So it's really, a lot of times you can talk to patients and figure out where the problem is coming from, and then you want to target. I'll be honest, sometimes I don't always know. If someone comes in and they're complaining of neck pain and shoulder pain and maybe some pain on the outside of their arm, I may order a cervical spine and a MRI of the shoulder as well, too, to really elucidate. And they may have problems in both. And I tell patients, look, we're going to try one thing, and if that doesn't work, then we're going to try another thing to figure out exactly what your pain symptoms are. Because the last thing you want is to send someone to a spine surgeon or to an orthopedic surgeon. They have some type of joint replacement, a rotator cuff repair, and they wake up from surgery and they say, my pain is no better. Because then it makes your surgical colleagues not look so good. The patient's unhappy, and then they're going to turn around and say, well, why did you do that to me? So the key, and a lot of times I tell patients, my injections, they are both diagnostic and therapeutic. If we do it, you feel much better. We know exactly what your problem is. And obviously you feel better, so it's a good thing. Right. So an epidural, you shouldn't be doing more than 3 to 4 times a year. The data has said doing it more often than that is really not beneficial to them. For the pure degenerative problems like the spinal stenosis, the facet arthritis, I tell patients, look, your pain is going to be here for the rest of your life. And really setting that expectation for them, I think psychologically, just preparing them for that is treatment in itself, because they realize, hey, someone's validated my pain symptoms. It's real that I have there. And sometimes it's going to be bad, and times it's not so bad. I tell patients, when your pain is really bad and you can't take it anymore, come back and see me. I'm happy to do an injection for you. If it's kind of there, it's not bothering you too much, you're able to do your everyday activities that are reasonable for your age, maybe you take a Tylenol once in a while, maybe you take some type of anti-inflammatory, again, once in a while, it manages it, no need to see me. So I do imaging. As soon as someone comes and sees me, if they haven't had imaging, I get it right away because I want to know what I'm dealing with. Now, in terms of the disability, I think that kind of falls on us. I think that we need to be telling patients, you shouldn't be laying in bed. You shouldn't be just kind of nursing this. You should be out there working as hard as you can. I get patients into physical therapy before I do an injection or immediately after an injection. I tell them, look, you got to work at this. All the studies have shown that doing your everyday activities, despite this stuff, you're going to have a better outcome. And the patients that are trying to apply for that disability, I think that's going to decrease because these Social Security and a lot of these disability companies, I mean, I've done some of these disability evaluations. They're very savvy about this stuff. They'll do undercover investigation. They'll do videos on patients. I reviewed a case. Lady was complaining of severe back pain, had two spine surgeries, but they had surveillance video of her walking from her car to her grandson's soccer game, holding a folding chair, sitting down with no assistance of another person, a cane, then lifts one of her grandkids onto her lap. So even though psychologically a patient will say, oh, I'm disabled, I think that we need to educate them and say, you need to get out there and be as functional as you can. I tell people all the time, unless you get into a terrible car accident, break some bones, or you fall off of a building, there's no reason you can't do your everyday activities. Even though you may have some discomfort, it may be a little bit uncomfortable, you got to push through it. That's okay. Not a lot. I don't expect people to be crying in tears on the ground, but it's okay to experience a little bit of pain. That's normal. Any other questions? Okay, thanks, guys.